forward. A computer command showed the contact's course track for the last 20 minutes. It had been moving along at mere steerage speed, about 5 knots. It was now doing 10, and had turned toward the trailing decoy group. That data was linked to USS O'Bannon, whose captain was the senior officer for the group. The range between the two ships was 16,000 yards and closing. Things got more interesting. Normandy's helicopter closed on the track from behind, keeping low. The pilots saw a green-white bloom as the unknown craft increased power, stirring the water and disturbing more of the organisms which somehow survived all the pollution here. A sudden burst of power meant... "That's a gunboat," the pilot reported over the data link. "He just goosed it. Target has just increased power." Kemper grimaced. He had a choice now. Do nothing, and maybe nothing would happen. Do nothing, and maybe give the gun missile boat the first shot at O'Bannon and her group. Do something, and risk alerting the other side. But if the enemy craft shot first, the enemy would know something anyway, right? Maybe, maybe not. It was a complex set of data for 5 seconds. He waited 5 more. Target is a missile boat. I see 2 launchers. Target steadying down on course. "He's got a direct line to O'Bannon, sir," Weps reported. "Radio chatter. I have radio chatter on UHF bearing 015. "Take the shot," Kemper said instantly. "Shoot," Weps said over the voice channel to the helo. "Roger, engaging." "Combat lookout, sir. I have a flash like a missile launch on the port quarter. Make that 2, sir," a speaker announced. "Give it a sweep." "2 more launches, sir." Shit, Kemper thought. The helo carried only 2 Penguin anti-ship missiles. The enemy had gotten the first 2 off, and he couldn't do anything now. The decoy group was fulfilling its function. It was getting shot at. 2 vampires inbound. Target destroyed, the pilot added, announcing the destruction of the missile boat, confirmed a moment later by the topside lookout. "Say again, 2 vampires inbound O'Bannon." "Silkworms are big targets," Weps said. They watched the mini-battle imperfectly. The navigation radar display showed O'Bannon changing course to port. That would be to unmask her point defense missile system, located far aft. It would also provide a huge radar target to the inbound missiles. The destroyer did not fire off her decoys for fear that spoofing the inbounds would only divert them to the replenishment ships she was guarding. An automatic decision? Kemper wondered. A considered one? Ballsy either way. The destroyer's illumination radar came on. That meant she was firing her missiles, but the navigation radar couldn't tell. Then at least one of the frigates joined in. "All kind of flashes aft," the topside lookout said next. "Wow, that was a big one. There goes another." Then 5 seconds of silence. "O'Bannon to group. We're okay," a voice reported. For now, Kemper thought. The Predators were up, 3 of them, 1 each for the 3 corps encamped southwest of Baghdad, motoring through the air at only twice the speed of a tank. None of them got as far as planned. 30 miles short of their objectives, their look-down thermal cameras showed the glowing shapes of armored vehicles. The Army of God was moving. The feed to Stormtrack was instantly cross-loaded to KKMC, and from there all over the world. "Another couple of days would have been nice," Ben Goodley thought aloud. "How ready are our people?" Ryan turned to the J-3. "The 10th's ready to rock. The 11th needs at least a day. The other brigade doesn't even have its equipment yet," Jackson replied. "How long before contact?" the president asked next. "At least 12 hours. Maybe 18. Depends on where they're going exactly." Jack nodded. "Arnie, has Callie been briefed in on all this?" "No, not at all." "Then let's get that done. I have a speech to make." Alahad must have gotten bored running a business with no customers, Loomis thought. He left early, walked to where his car was parked, and drove off. Tailing him on such empty streets would probably be fairly easy. A few minutes later, the subject was observed to park his car and enter his apartment building. Then she and Selig walked out of the unit they'd been in, crossed the street, and walked around the back. There were two locks on the door, which caused the junior agent to take 10 minutes to defeat them, much to his own annoyance. Then came the alarm system, but that was more easily accomplished. It was an old one with a socket key and a very simple disarming code. Inside they found a few more photos, one probably of his son. They checked the Rolodex first, and there was the card for Jay Sloan, with the number 536-4040, but no address.
"Tell me what you think," Loomis said.
"I think it's a new card, not dog-eared or anything like that. And I think there's a dot over the first numeral 4. Tells him which number to change, sis."
"This guy's a player, Donnie."
"I think you're right, and that makes Arif Rehman one, too. But how to prove it?" The cover might or might not have been blown. There was no knowing. Kemper assessed the situation as best he could. Maybe the missile boat had gotten off a broadcast and received permission to fire. Maybe the young commander had decided to shoot on his own. Probably not. Dictatorial countries didn't give much autonomy to their military commanders. If you were the dictator and you started doing that, it was a sure way to find your back to a wall sooner or later. The score to this point was USN 1 and UIR 0. Both groups were continuing, going southwest now into a widening gulf, still doing 26 knots, still surrounded by merchant traffic, and the electronic environment was alive with ship-to-ship chatter, wondering what the hell had just happened north of Abu Masa. Omani patrol boats were out now, and they were talking back and forth with somebody, perhaps the UIR, asking what was going on. In confusion, Kemper decided, there was profit. It was dark out, and identifying ships in darkness was never an easy business.
"When's nautical twilight?"
5 hours, sir," the quartermaster of the watch replied.
"That's 150 miles to the good.
We continue as before. Let them sort things out if they can.
Getting as far as Bahrain without detection would be miracle enough."
They laid it all out on Inspector O'Day's desk. It all amounted to 3 pages of notes and a couple of Polaroid photographs. The most important-looking tidbit was a printout of the phone records, duplicating Selig's scribbling. That was also the only legal piece of evidence they had.
"Not exactly the thickest pile of proof I've ever seen," Pat noted.
"Hey, Pat, you said to move fast," Loomis reminded him.
"They're both dirty. I can't prove it to a jury, but that's enough to start a major investigation, assuming we have the luxury of time, which I don't think we do."
"Correct. Come on," he said, rising. "We have to see the director."
It wasn't as though Murray weren't busy enough. The FBI wasn't exactly running the epidemiological investigation of all the Ebola cases, but the Bureau's agents were doing a lot of legwork. There was the ongoing and practically new case on the attack on Giant Steps, which was both criminal and FCI, and an interagency case to boot. And now this, the third put-everything-else-aside situation in less than 10 days. The inspector waved his way past the secretaries and walked into the director's office without a knock.
"It's a good thing I wasn't taking a leak," Murray observed.
"I didn't think you'd have time for that."
"I don't," Pat told him.
"There's probably a mole in the service after all, Dan."
"Oh?"
"Oh, yeah, and oh, shit. I'll let Loomis and Selig walk you through it."
"Can I take this to Andrea Price without getting shot?" the director asked.
"I think so."
Chapter 58. The Light of Day. It wasn't something to celebrate, but for the second day in a row, new Ebola cases had dropped. Of the new cases identified, moreover, about a third were people who tested positive for the antibodies, but were asymptomatic. CDC and USAMRID rechecked the data twice before reporting it to the White House, also cautioning that it was too preliminary to be released to the public. The travel ban, it seemed,
and the spin-off effects it was having on interpersonal contacts was working. But the president couldn't say it was working, because then it would stop working. The Giant Steps case was also ongoing, mainly a task of the FBI Laboratory Division. There, electronic microscopes were being used for something other than the identification of Ebola strands, and were narrowing in on pollen and other tiny particles. This was complicated by the fact that the Giant Steps attack had been made in the spring, when the air was full of pollens. Mordecai Azir, it was now firmly established, was a quintessential unperson who had sprung into existence seemingly for a single purpose, and, fulfilling it, had disappeared. But he had left behind photographs. And there were ways of dealing with that, Ryan learned. He wondered if there might be some good news to end the day. There wouldn't be. "Hi, Dan." He was back in his office. The Situation Room was just one more reminder that his next major order was to send people into combat. "Mr. President," the FBI director said, entering with Inspector O'Day and Andrea Price. "Why do you look so happy?" And then they told him. It was a brave man who awoke the Ayatollah Mahmoud Haji Dariai before dawn, and since those around him feared his wrath, it took 2 hours for them to summon the courage to do so. Not that it would help matters. At 4 in the morning in Tehran, the phone by the side of his bed rang. 10 minutes after that, he was in the sitting room of his private apartment, his dark, sunken eyes waiting to punish those responsible. "We have a report that American ships have entered the Gulf," the intelligence chief told him. "When and where?" the Ayatollah asked quietly. "It was after midnight at the Narrows. One of our missile patrol boats spotted what it reported to be an American destroyer. It was ordered in to attack by the local naval commander, but we've heard nothing more from the boat." "That is all? You awakened me for this?" "There was some radio traffic in the area, ships talking back and forth. They talked about several explosions. We have reason to believe that our missile boat was attacked and destroyed by someone, probably an aircraft. But an aircraft from where?" "We want your permission to commence air operations to sweep the Gulf after dawn. We have never done this without your word," the Air Force chief pointed out. "Permission is given," Dariai told them. Well, he was awake now, the cleric told himself. What else? "The Army of God is making its approach march to the border area. The operation is proceeding as scheduled." Surely this news would please him, the intelligence chief thought. Mahmoud Haji nodded. He'd hoped for a decent night's sleep in anticipation of being up long hours for the next few days. But it was his nature that, once awakened, he could not return to sleep. He looked at his desk clock. He didn't wear a watch. And decided that the day would have to begin. "Will we surprise them?" "Somewhat, certainly," intelligence responded. "The Army is under strict orders to maintain radio silence. The American listening posts are very sensitive, but they cannot hear nothing. When they reach Al-Busaya, we must expect detection, but then we will be ready to jump off, and it will be at night."
Dariai shook his head. "Wait, what did our patrol boat tell us?"
"He reported an American destroyer or frigate, possibly with other ships, but that was all. We will have aircraft up to look in 2 hours."
"They're transport ships?"
"We don't know," intelligence admitted. He'd hoped that they were past that.
"Find out!"
The two men took their leave with that order. Dariai rang his servant for tea. He had another thought just then. All would be settled, or at least solved, when the Rahman boy fulfilled his mission. The report was that he was in place and had received his order. Why, then, hadn't he fulfilled it? The Ayatollah asked himself with a building anger. He looked at the clock again. It was too early to make a call. Kemper had given his crew something akin to a stand-down. The automation of the Aegis ships made that possible, And so, starting 2 hours after the incident with the gunboat, missile boat, he corrected himself, crewmen were allowed to rotate off their battle stations, to relieve themselves, to get something to eat, and in many cases to pump a little iron. That had lasted an hour, with each officer and man having had 15 minutes. They were all back now. It was 2 hours to nautical twilight. They were just under 100 miles from Qatar, now heading west-northwest, after having dodged behind every island and oil platform that might confuse an enemy radar post. Comedy had been through the tough part. The Gulf was far wider here. There was sea room to maneuver in and to make full use of his powerful sensors. The radar picture in Anzio's CIC showed a flight of 4 F-16s 20 miles north of his formation, their IFF codes clear on the display. His people had to be careful about that. It would have been better if there could be an AWACS aloft, but, he had just learned an hour before, all of those were deployed up north. Today there would be a fight. It would not be the sort of thing Aegis had been designed for, or quite what he'd been trained for, but that was the Navy for you. The decoy group he ordered south. Their job was done for now. With the sun up, there would be no disguising what comedy was and where they were going, he thought.
How sure of this are you? POTUS asked. Christ, I've been alone with the guy 100 times.
We know, Price assured him. We know.
Sir, it's hard to believe. I've known Jeff on and off.
He's the basketball guy.
He told me who was going to win the NCAA finals.
He was right. His point spread was right on.
Yes, sir.
Andrea had to agree with that, too.
Unfortunately, these items are a little hard to explain.
Are you going to arrest him?
We can't. Murray took that one. It's one of those situations where you know, or think you know, but can't prove anything. Pat here has an idea, though.
Then let's hear it, Ryan ordered.
His headache was back.
No, that wasn't right. The intervening brief period without a headache had ended. Bad enough that he'd been told of the vague possibility that the Secret Service was compromised, but now they thought they had proof.
No, worse, he corrected himself. Not good enough for proof. Just more fucking suspicion that one of the people trusted to be around him and his family was a potential assassin. Would this never end?
But he listened anyway.
Actually, it's pretty simple, O'Day concluded.
No, Price said immediately. What if...
We can control that. There won't be any real danger, the inspector assured everyone.
Hold it, Swordsman said. You say you can smoke the guy out?
Yes, sir.
And I actually get to do something instead of just sitting here like a goddamn king?
Yes, sir, Pat repeated.
Where do I sign up? Ryan asked rhetorically. Let's do it.
Mr. President.
Andrea, you'll be here, right?
Well, yes, but...
Then it's approved, POTUS told her.
He doesn't get near my family. I mean that. If he even looks at the elevator, you take him down yourself, Andrea. Got that?
I understand, Mr. President. West wing only.
With that, they walked downstairs to the Situation Room, where Arnie and the rest of the National Security Team were watching a map display on a large screen TV.
Okay, let's light up the sky, Kemper told the CIC crew. On command, Anzio and the other 4 Aegis ships flipped their spy radars from standby to full radiated power. There was no percentage in hiding anymore. They were right under a commercial air route designated W-15, and any airline pilot could look down and see the small box of ships. When one did, he'd probably talk about it. The element of surprise had its practical limits. In a second, the 3 big screens showed numerous air tracks. This had to be the busiest hunk of airspace outside O'Hare, Kemper thought. The IFF scan showed a flight of 4 F-16 fighters deployed northwest of his formation. There were 6 airliners aloft, and the day had scarcely started. Missile specialists ran practice tracks just to exercise the computers,
But really, the Aegis system was designed to be one of those supposedly all-powerful things that could sit still 1 second and raise hell the next. They'd come to the right place to do that. The first Iranian fighters to head into the sky that day were two aged F-14 Tomcats from Shiraz. The Shah had purchased about 80 of the fighters from Grumman in the 1970s. 10 could still fly, with parts cannibalized from all the others, or procured on the world's lively black market in combat aircraft components. These flew southeast, overland to Bandar Abbas. Then they increased speed and darted south to Abu Musa, passing just north of it, with the pilots driving and the backseaters scanning the surface with binoculars. The sun was plainly visible at 20,000 feet, but on the surface there was still the semi-darkness of nautical twilight. One doesn't see ships from aloft, a fact often lost on both sailors and airmen. In most cases, ships are too small, and the surface of the sea too vast. What one sees, whether from a satellite photo or the unaided human eye, is the wake, a disturbance in the water much like an arrow with an oversized head. The bow and stern waves generated by the ship's passage through the water. And the foaming, a straight line caused by the propellers, is the arrow's shaft. The eye is drawn to such shapes as naturally as to the body of a woman, and at the apex of the V-shape, there one finds the ship. Or in this case, many ships. They spotted the decoy group first, from 40 miles away. The main body of comedy was identified a minute later. The problem for the ships was positive identification. Kemper couldn't risk killing an airliner, as USS Vincennes had once done. The four F-16s had already turned toward them when the radio call went out. He didn't have anyone aboard who spoke the language well enough to catch what they'd just said. "Tally-ho," the F-16 flight leader called. "Looks like F-14s." And he knew the Navy didn't have any of those around. "Anzio to Starfighter, weapons free. Splash 'em." "Roger that." "Flight lead, go slammer." They were too busy looking down instead of looking around. Recon flight, Starfighter lead figured. Tough. He selected AIM 120 and fired, a fraction before the other three aircraft in his formation did the same. "Fox 1, Fox 1. And the Battle of Qatar was underway. The UIR Tomcats were just a little too busy for their own good. Their radar warning receivers were reporting all manner of emitters at the moment, and the air-to-air radar on the Vipers was just one of many. The leader of the two was trying to get a count of the warships below, and talking on his radio at the same time, when a pair of AMRAAM missiles exploded 20 meters in front of his aging fighter. The second pilot at least looked up in time to see death coming. "Anzio, Starfighter, Splash 2. No shoots. Say again, Splash 2. "Roger that." "What a nice way to start the day," commented a USAF major who'd just spent 16 months playing against the Israeli Air Force in the Negev. "Returning to station. Out." "I'm not sure that's a good idea," Van Damme said. The radar picture from John Paul Jones had been uplinked from the new ship via satellite to Washington. They were seeing things less than half a second after they really happened. "Those ships cannot be stopped, sir," Robbie Jackson told the chief of staff. "We can't take chances."
"But they can say we shot first and—" "Wrong, sir. Their missile boat shot first 5 hours ago," the J-3 reminded him.
"But they won't say that."
"Save it, Arnie," Ryan said. "My order, remember? The rules of engagement are in place."
"What now, Robbie?"
"Depends on whether the Iranians got the word out. That first kill was easy."
"The first one usually is," Jackson said, remembering the ones he'd made in his career. Nothing at all like what he'd trained for at Top Gun. But there were no fair play rules in real combat, were there? The narrowest part of the passage was just over 100 miles between Qatar and the Iranian town of Basatin.
There was an airbase there, and satellite coverage said there were fighters sitting on the ramp.
"Hi, Jeff."
"What's happening, Andrea?" Raymond asked, adding, "Glad you remembered that you left me up here."
"It's pretty busy with all this fever stuff. We need you back here. Got a car?"
"I think I can steal one from the local office."
In fact, he had an official car already.
"Okay," she told him, "come on down. I don't suppose we really need the advance work up there. Your ID will get you through the roadblocks on I-70. Quick as you can. Things are happening here."
"Give me 4 hours."
"You have a change of clothes?"
"Yeah, why?"
"You're going to need it. We've set up decontamination procedures here. Everybody has to scrub down before getting into the West Wing."
"You'll see when you get here," the chief of the detail told him.
"Fine with me."
Alahad wasn't doing anything. Bugs planted in his house had determined that he wasn't watching TV, flipping channels from one cable station to another in search of a movie he hadn't seen before. And before going to bed, he'd listened to CNN headline news. After that, nothing. The lights were all out, and even the thermal viewing cameras couldn't see through the curtained windows of his bedroom. The agents doing surveillance drank their coffee from plastic cups and looked on, at nothing, while discussing their worries about the epidemic, just like everyone else in America. The media continued to devote virtually all of its airtime to the story. There was little else. Sports had stopped. Weather continued, but few were outside to notice. Everything else rotated around the Ebola crisis. There were science segments explaining what the virus was and how it spread. Actually, how it might be spreading, as there was still diverse opinion on that. And the agents with the headphones had listened to the latest installment over Alahad's own TV. It was all nature's revenge, one environmental advocate was preaching. Man had gone into the jungle, cut down trees, killed animals, upset the ecosystem, and now the ecosystem was getting even. Or something like that. There was legal analysis of the court case Edward Keelty had brought, but there simply was no enthusiasm for lifting the travel ban. Stories showed airplanes at airports, buses in terminals, trains at stations, and a lot of empty roads. Stories showed people in hotels and how they were coping. Stories showed how to reuse surgical masks and told people that this simple safety measure worked almost flawlessly. Most people seemed to believe that. But to counter that, most of the stories showed hospitals, and now body bags. Reports on how the bodies of the dead were being burned ran without showing the flames. That was by mutual consent. The raw data was distasteful enough without the image of its reality. Reporters and medical consultants were starting to comment on the lack of data on the number of cases, which was alarming to many, but hinting that the space in hospitals to deal with the Ebola cases had not expanded, which was comforting to some. The extreme doom and gloomsayers were still distributing their cant, but others said quietly that the data didn't support that view, that the situation might be stabilizing, though in every case they added that it was much too soon to tell. They were starting to say that people were coping, that some states were totally clean, that many regions within those states that had cases were similarly healthy. And finally, some people were coming forward to say with some authority that the epidemic had definitely not been a natural event. There was no public opinion on the issue that the media could really measure. People didn't interact enough, share thoughts enough to make informed judgments. But with the beginnings of confidence that the world was not going to end came the big question. How had this begun? Secretary of State Adler was back in his airplane, flying west to the People's Republic. While aloft and in the Beijing embassy, he had access to the latest news. It had caused rage and, perversely, some degree of satisfaction. It was Zhang who was leading his government in this direction. That was fairly certain, now that they knew India had been involved, again, this time duped by Iran and China. The real question was whether or not the Prime Minister would let her partners know that she'd reneged on her part of the deal. Probably not, Adler thought. She'd outmaneuvered herself again. She seemed able to do that standing still. But the rage kept coming back. His country had been attacked, and by someone he'd met only a few days before. Diplomacy had failed. He had failed to stop a conflict. And wasn't that his job? Worse than that, he and his country had been duped. China had maneuvered him and a vital naval force out of position. The PRC was now stringing out a crisis they'd made themselves for the purpose of hurting American interests, and probably for the ultimate purpose of reshaping the world into their own design. They were being clever about it. China had not directly done anything to anyone, except a few air passengers, but had let others take the lead, and the risks that went with them. However this turned out, they would still have their trade, they would still have the respect due a superpower, and influence over American policy, and they planned to maintain all of those things until such time as they made the changes they desired. They'd killed Americans on the Airbus. Through their maneuvers, they were helping to kill others, to do real and permanent harm to his country, and doing so entirely without risk, Sextate thought quietly, gazing out the window as his aircraft made landfall. But they didn't know that he knew these things, did they? The next attack would be a little more serious. The UIR had a large supply of C-802 missiles, so intelligence said. Made by China Precision Machine Import and Export Corporation, these were similar in type and capabilities to the French Exocet, with a range of about 70 miles. However, again the problem was targeting. There were just too many ships in the Gulf. To get the right destination for their missiles, the Iranians would have to get close enough for the look-down radars on their fighters to brush the edge of Comedy's missile envelope. Well, Kemper decided, he'd have to see about that. John Paul Jones increased speed to 32 knots and moved north. The new destroyer was stealthy. On a radar set, she looked rather like a medium-sized fishing boat, and, to accentuate it, she turned off all her radars. Comedy had shown them one look. Now they would show them another. He also radioed Riyadh and screamed for AWACS support. The three cruisers, Anzio, Normandy, and Yorktown, maintained position close to the cargo ships, and it was now pretty clear to the civilian crews on the Bob Hopes that the warships were not there merely for missile defense. Any inbound vampire would have to go through a cruiser to get to them. But there was nothing to be done about that. The civilian seamen were all at their duty stations. Firefighting gear was deployed throughout the cargo decks. Their diesels were pounding out all the continuous power that the manuals allowed. Aloft, the Dawn Patrol of F-16s was replaced by another. Weapons were free, and word was getting out now to the civilian traffic that the air over the Persian Gulf was not a good place to be. It would make everyone's task a lot easier. It was no secret that they were there. Iranian radar had to have them, but there was no helping that at the moment. "It appears that there are two naval forces in the Gulf," intelligence told him. "We are not sure of their composition, but it is possible that they are military transport ships."
"And?"
"And two of our fighters have been shot down approaching them," Air Force went on. "The American ships, some of them are warships of a very modern type. The report from our aircraft said that there are others as well, looking like merchant ships. It is likely that these are tank transports from Diego Garcia."
"The ones the Indians were supposed to stop."
"That is probably correct."
"What a fool I was to trust that woman."
"Sink them," he ordered, thinking that his wish could become a fact. Raymond liked to drive fast. The nearly clear interstate, the dark night, and the powerful service car allowed him to indulge that pastime, as he tore down Interstate 70 toward Maryland. The number of trucks on the road surprised him. He hadn't known that there were so many vehicles dedicated to moving food and medical supplies. His rotating red light told them to keep out of his way, and also allowed his passage at speeds approaching 100 miles per hour without interference from the Pennsylvania State Police. It also gave him time to think. It would have been better for everyone if he'd known beforehand about all the things that were happening. Certainly it would have been better for him. The attack on Sandbox had not pleased him. She was a child, too young, too innocent to be an enemy. He knew her by face and name and sound. And the shock of it had disturbed him briefly. He didn't quite understand why it had been ordered, unless to draw the protective circle even more tightly around POTUS, and so make his own mission easier. But that hadn't been necessary, not really. America was not Iraq, which Mahmoud Haji probably didn't fully understand. The disease attack, that was something else. The manner of its spread was a matter of God's will. It was distasteful, but that was life. He remembered the burning of the theater in Tehran. People had died there, too, ordinary people whose mistake had been to watch a movie instead of attending to their devotions. The world was hard, and the only thing that made its burden easier to bear was faith in something larger than oneself. Raymond had that faith. The world didn't change its shape by accident. Great events had to be cruel ones, for the most part. The faith had spread with the help of the sword, despite the prophet's own admonition that the sword could not make one faithful. A dichotomy he did not fully understand, but that too was the nature of the world. One man could hardly comprehend it all. For so many things one had to depend on the guidance of those wiser than oneself, to tell one what had to be done, what was acceptable to Allah, what served his purpose. That he had not been told things that would have been useful, well, he had to admit, that was a reasonable security measure. If one accepted the fact that one was not supposed to survive, the realization did not bring a chill along with it. He had accepted that possibility a long time before, and if his distant brother could have fulfilled his mission in Baghdad, then he could fulfill his own in Washington. But he would try to survive if the chance offered itself. There wasn't anything wrong with that, was there? Clearly they were still figuring this operation out, Kemper told himself. In 1990-91, there had been the luxury of time to decide things, to allocate assets, to set up communications links and all the rest. But not this time. When he'd called for the AWACS, some Air Force puke had replied, "What? You don't have one? Why didn't you ask?" The commanding officer of USS Anzio and Task Force 61.1 hadn't vented his temper at the man. It probably wasn't his fault anyway, and the good news was that they had one now. The timing was good enough, too. 4 fighter aircraft, type unknown, were just rotating off the ground at Basatin, 90 miles away. "Comedy, this is Sky 2. We show 4 inbounds." The data link came up on one of the Aegis screens. His own radar couldn't see that far, because it was well under the horizon. The AWACS showed 4 blips in 2 pairs. "Sky, Comedy, they're yours. Splash 'em." "Roger. Stand by. 4 more coming up." "Here's where it gets interesting," Jackson told them in the sit room. "Kemper has a missile trap set up outboard of the main formation. If anybody gets past the 16s, we'll see if it works." A third group of 4 lifted off a minute later. The 12 fighter aircraft climbed to 10,000 feet, then turned south at high speed. The flight of F-16s couldn't risk straying too far from Comedy, but moved to meet the threat in the center of the Gulf under direction from the AWACS. Both sides switched on their targeting radars, the UIR force controlled by ground-based sets, and the USAF teams guided by the E-3B circling 100 miles behind them. It wasn't elegant. The 16s, with their longer-ranging missiles, shot first, and turned away as the southbound Iranian interceptors loosed their own and tried to evade. Then the first group of four dived down for the water. Jamming pods went on, aided by powerful shore-based interference, which the Americans hadn't expected. Three UIR fighters, still heading in, fell to the missile volley, while the Americans outran the return volley, then turned back to re-engage. The American flight split into two plane elements, racing east, then turned again to conduct an anvil attack. But the speeds involved were high, and one Iranian flight was now within 50 miles of Comedy. That was when they appeared on Anzio's radar. "Cap'n," the chief on the ESM board said into his microphone, "I am getting acquisition radar signals bearing 355. These are detection value, sir. They may have us." "Very well." Kemper reached to turn his key. On Yorktown and Normandy, the same thing happened. The former was an older version of the cruiser. In her case, four white-painted SM-2 MR came out of the fore and aft magazines onto the launch rails. For Anzio and Normandy, nothing changed visually. Their missiles were in vertical launch cells. The spy radars were now pumping out 6 million watts of RF energy, and dwelling almost continuously on the inbound fighter bombers, which were just out of range of the cruisers. But not out of range for John Paul Jones, 10 miles to the north of the main body. In the space of 3 seconds, her main radar went active, and then the first of 8 missiles erupted from her launch cells, rocketing skyward on columns of smoke and flame, then changing direction in skidding turns to level out and burn north. The fighters hadn't seen Jones. Her stealthy profile had not shown as a real target on their scopes, and neither had they noticed the fact that a fourth spy radar was now tracking them. The series of white smoke trails came as an unpleasant surprise when the pilots looked up from their own radar scopes, but two of them triggered off their C-802s just in time. 4 seconds out from their targets, the SM-2 missiles received terminal guidance signals from the SPG-62 illumination radars. It was too sudden, too unexpected for them to jink clear. All four fighters were blotted out on massive clouds of yellow and black, but they'd managed to launch 6 anti-ship missiles. "Vampire, vampire, I show inbound missile seekers bearing 350. "Okay, here we go." Kemper turned the key another notch, to the special auto setting. Aegis would now go fully automatic. Topside, the Seawis Gatling guns turned to starboard. Everywhere aboard the four warships, sailors listened and tried not to cringe. The merchant crews they guarded simply didn't know to be scared yet. Aloft, the F-16s closed on the still-intact flight of four. These were also anti-ship missile carriers, but they'd looked in the wrong place, probably for the decoy group. The first group had seen a close gaggle of ships. The second hadn't yet, and never would. They just turned into the signals of the Aegis radars to their west when the sky filled with downbound smoke trails. The four scattered. Two exploded in midair. Another was damaged and tried to limp back northwest before he lost power and went in, while a fourth, missed entirely, reefed into a left turn, punched burner, and jettisoned his exterior weapons load. The four Air Force F-16s had splashed 6 enemy fighters in under 4 minutes. Jones got one of the sea skimmers on the way by, but none of them had locked onto her radar return, and the resulting high-speed crossing targets were too difficult to engage. 3 of 4 computer-launched attempts all failed. That left 5. The destroyer's combat systems recycled and looked for additional targets. They'd seen Jones's smoke and wondered what it was, but the first real warning that something was badly wrong came when the near trio of cruisers started launching. In Anzio CIC, Kemper decided, as O'Bannon had, not to launch his decoy rockets. 3 of the inbound seemed aimed at the after part of the formation, with only 2 at the lead. His cruiser and Normandy concentrated on those. You could feel the launches. The hull shivered when the first 2 went out.
The radar display was changing every second now, showing inbound and outbound tracks. The vampires were 8 miles away now. At 10 miles per minute, that meant less than 50 seconds to engage and destroy. It would seem like a week. The system was programmed to adopt a fire control mode appropriate to the moment. It was now doing shoot-shoot-look. Fire one missile, fire another, and then look to see if the target had survived the first two, and merit a third try. His target was exploded by the first SM-2 and the second SAM self-destructed. Normandy's first missile missed, but the second nicked the C-802, tumbling it into the sea with an explosion they felt through the hull a second later. Yorktown had an advantage and a disadvantage. Her older system allowed launches directly at the inbound missiles, instead of forcing the missiles to turn in flight before they could engage. But she could not launch as fast. She had 3 targets and 50 seconds to destroy them. The first 802 splashed 5 miles out, killed by a double hit. The second was now at its terminal height of 3 meters, 10 feet over the flat surface. The next outgoing SM-2 missed high, exploding harmless behind it. The following missile missed as well. The next ripple from the forward launchers obliterated that one 3 miles out, filling the air with fragments that confused the guidance of the next pair, causing both to explode in the shredded remains of a dead target. Both of the cruiser's launchers swiveled fore and aft and vertical to receive the next set of 4 SAMs. The last 802 passed through the spray and fragments, heading straight into the cruiser. Yorktown got off 2 more launches, but one faulty missile failed to guide at all, and the other missed. Then the SEWIS systems located on the forward and after superstructure turned slightly, as the vampire entered their targeting envelope. Both opened up at 800 yards, missing yet again, but then exploding the missile less than 200 yards off the starboard beam. The 500-pound warhead showered the cruiser with fragments, and parts of the missile body kept coming, striking the ship's fore-right spy radar panel and ripping into the superstructure, killing 6 sailors and wounding 20 more.
"Wow," Secretary Brentano said. All the theoretical stuff he'd learned in the past weeks was suddenly real.
"Not bad. They've launched 14 aircraft at us, and they're getting 2 or 3 back, that's all," Robbie said. "That'll give them something to think about for the next time."
"What about Yorktown?" the president asked.
"We have to wait and see."
Their hotel was only 1/2 mile from the Russian embassy, and like good parsimonious journalists, they decided to walk, and left a few minutes before 8. Clark and Chavez had gone a scarce 100 yards when they saw that something was wrong. People were moving listlessly for so early on the start of a working day. Had the war with the Saudis been announced? John took a turn onto another market street, and there he found people listening to portable radios in their stalls instead of moving their wares onto the shelves.
"Excuse me," John said in Russian-accented Farsi. "Is something the matter?"
"We are at war with America," a fruit vendor said.
"Oh, when did this happen?"
"The radio says they have attacked our airplanes," the fruit seller said next.
"Who are you?" he asked.
John pulled out his passport.
"We are Russian journalists. Can I ask what you think of this?"
"Haven't we fought enough?" the man asked.
"Told you, they're blaming us," Arnie said, reading over the intercept report off Tehran radio. "What will that do to the politics in the region?"
"The sides are pretty much drawn up," Ed Foley said.
"You're either on one side or the other. The UIR is the other. Simpler than the last time."
The president checked his watch. It was just past midnight.
"When do I go on the air?"
"Noon."
Raymond had to stop at the Maryland-Pennsylvania line. A good 20 or so trucks were waiting for clearance from the Maryland State Police, with the National Guard in close attendance, and they lined up 2 by 2, completely blocking the road at this point. 10 angry minutes later, he showed his ID. The cop waved him through without a word. Raymond turned his light back on and sped off. He turned on the radio, caught an all-news AM station, but missed the top of the hour news summary and had to suffer through all the rest. Largely the same thing he'd been hearing all week, until 12:30, when the network news service announced a reported air battle in the Persian Gulf. Neither the White House nor the Pentagon had commented on the alleged incident. Iran claimed to have sunk two American ships and shot down four fighters. Patriot and zealot that he was, Raymond couldn't believe it. The problem with America, and the reason for his mission of sacrifice, was that this poorly organized, idolatrous, and misguided nation was lethally competent in the use of force. Even President Ryan, he had seen, discounted as he was by politicians, had a quiet strength to him. He didn't shout, didn't bluster, didn't act like most great men. He wondered how many people appreciated just how dangerous Swordsman was, for that very reason. Well, that was why he had to kill him. And if that had to come at the cost of his own life, so be it. TF-61.1 turned south behind the Qatar Peninsula without further incident. Yorktown's forward superstructure was badly damaged, the electrical fire having done as much damage as the missile fragments. But with her stern turned to the enemy, that didn't matter. Kemper maneuvered his escorting ships yet again, placing all four behind the tank carriers. But another attack was not forthcoming. The result of the first had stung the enemy too badly. 8 F-15s, four each of the Saudi Air Force and the 366th, orbited overhead. A mixture of Saudi and other escort ships turned up. Mainly mine hunters, they pinged the bottom in front of Comedy, looking for danger and finding none. Six huge container ships had been moved off the Dharan Quay to make room for Bob Hope and her sisters, and now three tugs each appeared to move them alongside. The four Aegis ships maintained station, even sitting still, dropping their anchors fore and aft, mooring 500 yards off their charges to maintain air defense coverage through the unloading process. The decoy force, having suffered not a single scratch, pulled into Bahrain to await developments. From the wheelhouse of USS Anzio, Captain Gregory Kemper watched as the first brown buses pulled up to the tank carriers. Through his binoculars he could see men in chocolate-chip fatigues trot to the edge, and watched the stern ramps come down to meet them. "We have no comment at this time," Van Damme told the latest reporter to call in. "The President will be making a statement later today. That's all I can say right now. But that's all we have to say right now." The Chief of Staff killed the line. Price had assembled all of the detail agents in the West Wing and gone through the game plan for what was coming. The same would be repeated for the people in the White House proper, and the reaction there would be pretty much the same, she was certain. Shock, disbelief, and anger bordering on rage. "Let's all get that out of our system, shall we? We know what we're going to be doing about it. This is a criminal case, and we'll treat it like a criminal case. Nobody loses control. Nobody gives anything away. Questions?" There were none. Dariai checked his clock again. Yes, finally it was time. He placed a telephone call over a secure line to the UIR embassy in Paris. There the ambassador placed a call to someone else. That person made a call to London. In all cases the words exchanged were innocuous. The message was not. Past Cumberland, Hagerstown, Frederick, Raymond turned south on I-270 for the last hour's worth into Washington. He was tired, but his hands tingled. He'd see a dawn this morning. Perhaps his last. If so, he hoped it would be a pretty one. The noise made the agents jump. Both checked their watches. First of all, the number calling in came up on an LED display. It was overseas, code 44, which made it from the UK. "Yes?" It was the voice of the subject, Mohammed Alahad. "Sorry to disturb you so early. I call about the 3-meter Isfahan, the red one. Has it arrived yet? My customer is very anxious." The voice was accented, but not in quite the right way. "Not yet," the groggy voice replied.
I have asked my supplier about it. Very well, but as I said, my customer is quite anxious. I will see what I can do. Goodbye. And the line went dead. Don Selig lifted his cellular phone, dialed headquarters, and gave them the UK number for a quick check.
"Lights just came on," Agent Scott said. "Looks like it woke our boy up. Heads up," she said into her portable radio. "Subject is up and moving." "Got the light, Sylvia," another agent assured her.
5 minutes later, he emerged from the front door of the garden-style apartment building. Tracking him was not the least bit easy, but the agents had taken the trouble to locate the four closest public phones and had people close to all of them. It turned out that he picked one at a combination gas station convenience store. The computer monitor would tell them what number he called, but through a long-lens camera, he was observed to drop in a quarter. The agent on the camera saw him hit 363 in rapid succession. It was clear a few seconds later when another tapped phone rang and was answered by a digital answering machine.
"Mr. Sloan, this is Mr. Allahad. Your rug is in. I don't understand why you do not call me, sir."
Click.
Bingo, another agent called over the radio net. "That's it. He called Raymond's number.
Mr. Sloan, we have your rug."
Yet another voice came on. "This is O'Day. Take him down right now." It wasn't really all that hard. Allahad went into the store to buy a quart of milk, and from there he walked directly back home. He had to use a key to enter his apartment house, and was surprised to find a man and a woman inside.
"FBI," the man said.
"You're under arrest, Mr. Allahad," the woman said, producing handcuffs. No guns were in evidence, but he didn't resist. They rarely did. And if he had, there were two more agents just outside now.
"But why?" he asked.
"Conspiracy to murder the President of the United States," Sylvia Scott said, pushing him against the wall.
"That's not so."
"Mr. Allahad, you made a mistake. Joseph Sloan died last year." "How do you sell a rug to a dead man?" she asked. The man jerked back as though from an electric shock, the agent saw. The clever ones always did when they found out that they had not been so clever at all. They never expected to be caught. The next trick was in exploiting the moment. That would start in a few minutes when they told him what the penalty was for violating 18 U.S. Code Section 1751. The inside of USNS Bob Hope looked like the parking garage from hell, with vehicles jammed in so closely that a rat would have had a difficult time passing between them. To board a tank, an arriving crew had to walk on the decks of the vehicles, crouching lest they smash their skulls into the overhead, and they found themselves wondering about the sanity of those who'd periodically had to check the vehicles, turning over the engines and working the guns back and forth so that rubber and plastic seals wouldn't dry out. Assigning crews to tracks and trucks had been an administrative task of no small proportions, but the ship was loaded in such a way as to allow the most important items off first. The guardsmen arrived as units, with computerized printouts giving them the number and location of their assigned vehicles, and ship crewmen pointing them to the quickest way out. Less than an hour after the ship tied up, the first M1A2 main battle tank rolled off the ramp onto the quay to board the same tank transporter used shortly before by a tank of the 11th Cav, and with the same drivers. Unloading would take more than a day, and most of another would be needed to get Wolfpack Brigade organized. The dawn proved to be a pretty one, Arif Raymond saw with satisfaction as he pulled into West Executive Drive. It would be a clear day for his mission. The uniformed guard at the gate waved hello as the security barrier went down. Another car came in behind him, and that one went through as well. It parked two spaces from his spot, and Raymond recognized the driver as that FBI guy, O'Day, who'd been so lucky at the daycare center. There was no sense in hating the man. He'd been defending his own child, after all.
"How are you doing?" the FBI inspector asked cordially.
"Just got in from Pittsburgh," Raymond replied, hefting his suitcase out of the trunk.
"What the hell were you doing up there?"
"Advance work. But that speech won't be happening, I guess."
"What are you in for?"
Raymond was grateful for the distraction. It allowed him to get his mind into the game, as it were. "The director and I have something to brief the boss about. Got a shower first, though."